We're studying the flood. We have five lessons left after today, five, maybe six, I always forget. And if we're going to give today's title, give the lesson title, we're going to talk about the hydroplane theory. I introduced it last week. Hydroplane theory. Now, I'm still struggling with getting a computer screen that you can read, because on mine it's very small, so it makes it difficult. So that's why I need my pointer to keep track of where I am. Kind of a review of last week, or get you oriented. The canopy theory was the first widely held science creationist viewpoint of the pre-flood earth, Whitcomb and Morse. Still a very popular book. And with a lot of great ideas in it. The ideas cover the necessary issues, such as the greenhouse effect, a layer of water to insulate and distribute temperature. It's possible, that still is possible, but a very reduced amount of water. Secondly, it cannot really, the greenhouse effect cannot account for the major source of water that was produced in the flood. But a lot of things it claims that probably are true. I thought as I went through this, a good study would be you take them both and compare them side by side. And I didn't do that. So we're just going to ignore pretty much what Whitcomb said, not knowing how much we agree and how much we disagree. But they do have answers for the volcanoes and the magma flow and the smoke changing atmosphere and solar radiation and the earthquakes and earth crust changing and the mountain growth and the sagging sea floors and ages and the warmer oceans and the ice melt and from the glaciers and some kind of equilibrium that finally gets established, you know, end up in the same place. So we did not take time to compare these models feature by feature. What we are going to present, again, a good study, and it's not going to happen here, is that somebody takes all these together and compares them and comes up with the one that seems to work best. I'm not in any position to do that. I'll admit that. So we're going to work down a system that somebody else has worked out and be somewhat critical of it and learn from it. And the system is well documented in the book that I've talked about. It's called In the Beginning by Walt Brown. One thing that's very nice about this book, as godly men, people do, is they're not terribly stingy about what they've done. So his stuff's available on the internet. And I don't know that every page of his book is available on the internet, but you can see a lot of the stuff we're going to see right here tonight on your screen at home in the comfort of your living room. So that's kind of nice, because this is very, very difficult material. The book is some 400 pages long, and you can see it's a big, fat, heavy book with a lot of illustrations. And if you're going to teach through all of this book, it would take you a couple of years. So what we try to do in our short time together, I try to do for you during the week, is pull out those things that really seem to be an issue or help us understand what's happening in this scenario. And we're not going to do it tonight. We're just going to do it, a phase of it. Now, we've got to remind ourselves, and this group here seems to be understanding this part, we are presenting an alternative view of science involved in the flood. We're sure, to be sure, we're still dealing with models, human-made models, of how the dynamics of the flood occurred. What I'm saying about you, you're patient in learning all this. Even in this scenario, errors will be discovered and further refinement will occur. And I make note of this, that his book is now already in the 8th edition. That's not bad, because he's really willing to refine what he's learned and include new thoughts or better thoughts and so forth. So if somebody has one edition and he's living by it and we're not going to change it, that doesn't sound like it'd be good science. Now, of course, some of us, and none of us are here like this, we can dispatch this whole investigation simply and correctly by saying God did it and I don't care to know how he did it. And just go on with, you know, whatever you do. But as we said before, an inquiry into science is an inquiry into the very character of God, the nature of God. And it should be welcomed, not feared. It'll take a lot of work and diligence, but diligence provides adequate rewards. So again, only in Christianity is God consequential enough to warrant inquiry into his acts. Thus, our inquiry is in reality an inquiry into God. That's why it's so exciting. Well, Walt Blount Brown gives us some preliminary remarks here. New evidence shows that the earth has experienced a devastating worldwide flood whose waters violently burst forth from under the earth's crust. The standard textbook explanation for many of these earth major features are scientifically flawed. We can now explain, using well-understood phenomena, how this cataclysmic event rapidly formed so many features. So these and other mysteries are best explained by an earth-shaking event far more catastrophic than most anyone imagined. And I don't know that I can overstate that. When we get through studying this, it is absolutely overwhelming what happened to the earth at the time of the flood. It's a wonder that Noah survived. We talk about parsimony, that's right, as a word used here, and it relates to picking the simplest solution for the problem is probably the best one. And we use it a lot of times in finances, being, you know, cheap and all that kind of stuff, you know. But it also is related to the phrase we've also used here, like Occam's razor, which again is that principle that, the principle generally recommends selecting the competing hypothesis that makes the fewest assumptions. All right? And that's what Mr. Brown proposes. He says, only one assumption underlies the hydroplate theory. All else follows from that assumption and the laws of physics. So he starts out with a miraculously created world. And from that point on, in terms of comes the flood, it runs on its own. Now, there's got to be certain things that we don't understand totally, and there's probably got to be something, perhaps that might be classified as a miracle. But by and large, he tries to explain it on the basis of the laws of physics, which are God's law. In the process, I don't want to go through all this, but in the process, he gives us a complete picture of the Grand Canyon, the mid-ocean ridge, the continental shelves and slope, the ocean trenches, the ring of fire in the Pacific, earthquakes, magnetic variation on the ocean floor, submarine canyons, coal and oil, methane hydrates, ice age, frozen mammoths, major mountain ranges, overthrust volcanoes, lava, geothermal heat, strata, layered fossils, limestone, megamorphic rocks, plateaus, the Moho, that's a good one, salt domes, jigsaw fit of continents, changing axis tilt, and comets. That's not a good spelling. Asteroids and meteoroids. That's kind of like the waterfront. You got all those answers, you probably pretty well don't have to worry about the rest. I want to remind you that we sometimes lean a little bit towards depending on miracles too quickly. In our thinking, and I want to remind you that the science laws, we often forget or do not know the enormity of the importance of the laws of nature or of God, God's natural laws. We may thus underrate the importance and opt rather for a more important, quote, important, spectacular miracle than let the laws of science do the lawmaker's will. On the other side, we have the miracles of setting aside the laws of science to do something outside of these laws. But is that miracle more miraculous than the laws given by the lawgiver? Are we more impressed with the miraculous and unplussed by the laws of science? I think they're equal because they're both authored by God. The miracles are just sort of an anomaly to the regular laws. And I think science is worthy of our study. And it becomes, again, as we said, a look into the nature of God. Well, our assumption is not a groundless guess. I added that. So what is a hydroplate? Or the hydroplate theory. Before the global flood, considerable water was under the earth's crust. I've shown that here. I showed that to you last week. This is a schematic. It's certainly not to scale, but the idea shows that there's water as well as a connecting point to the earth. We call those columns or attachments. We call this the roof and we call this the floor. And there are multiple, probably thousands of these pillars that are scattered throughout the world, the earth. Now, think about the water. Pressure increases in the subterranean water, ruptured the crust, breaking it into plates. The escaping water flooded the earth. Because hydro means water, those crust plates will be called hydroplates. When they broke, how they moved, and the hundreds of other details and evidence all consistent with the laws of physics, constitute hydroplate theory and explain to a great extent why the earth looks as it does. Of course, that's the object of his study. We have some verses tonight I want to bring to you. Psalm 75:3 says, the earth and all who dwell in it melt in front of God. It is I who have firmly set its pillars. Set its, the pillars of the earth is the implication here. Now, a lot of these verses have this expression, and we sort of think right away, well, these are metaphorical. Have you seen a pillar on the earth? Are we thinking Corinthian columns, Doric columns, or a what kind of columns are we talking about? So we think metamorphically, there's some column out there that sort of holds the earth up. It's not Atlas in Greek mythology holds it up, but we think there's some columns there. Well, maybe there's some more literalness to these words. We might first give credit. So we have pillars, probably these structures that actually separate and support the earth's crust from the water below it, okay? All right, so we have this crust. This is considered no more than or around 10 miles. So we have a pretty deep crust. Although, again, go back to our basketball analogy of last week. If you take the basketball, it's about a foot in diameter, you feel the knobbies that are on the basketball, that's probably the thickness of the crust of the earth. We said a paper thin, it's actually thinner than a piece of paper that's 20-pound weight paper. Thinner than that is the crust of the earth, which we say is 10 miles. Remember, the world is nearly 7,000 miles in diameter. Okay. So we have this moho, just interestingly, and that's the part that is not touched by the by the flood. It was not rearranged below the moho, and it's named after a guy whose name I won't even try to pronounce because it goes, I'm losing my mouse here, right down there. All right, so we have a little scale here on all of this outer core, upper mantle, lower mantle, and we have this outer crust that we're dealing with is shown as just a line on the top of this stack. Don't die on me, mouse. Okay, so the assumption is before the global flood, considerable water was under the earth's crust. That's going to get explained a little bit more. And I would say hardly an assumption because the Bible talks about this being there. About half of the water now in the oceans was once interconnected chambers about 10 miles below the entire earth's surface. At thousands of locations, the chamber's sagging ceiling pressed against the chamber's floor. These extensive solid contacts will be called pillars. Maybe that's what the Bible calls the foundations. These extensive solid contacts will be called pillars. The average thickness of the subterranean water is about 3/4 of a mile, around 4,000 feet. Above the subterranean waters was a granite crust. Beneath the waters was a layer of basaltic rock, kind of like lava rock. Moving on. I'm scared to do some of this stuff, but hang with me here, okay? Got a little bit of science here. If I can get my mouse to go up there. Come on, lift up. What was that? Okay, talk to water now and what the water is capable of doing that we're not used to. Water at atmospheric pressure, we call it one atmosphere, is 14.7 pounds per square inch. Now, at 3,200 pounds per square inch, water will cease to boil. at 705 degrees and up. I don't have that concept. That's a relative new concept, apparently, that water will not boil above a certain time. But the pressure continued to get greater and heavier on it. And when it does, it has the ability to contain more and more minerals in suspension or in it, okay? Which will be needed later on. So this water cannot boil, but it's called supercritical water, SCW. And it lays below this 10-mile level at pressure of 62,000 PSI. That is a lot. That just takes the stack of rock, stack it up 10 miles, and what's the pressure you get on that per square inch? So the temperature is way above that supercritical water temperature. Now, after centuries of heat buildup from friction due to tidal pumping, we'll explain that a little bit later, due to tidal pumping, the crust was stretched to the cracking point. So this supercritical water can dissolve much more salt, limestone, quartz, silica, and minerals like calcium, carbon, and oxygen than normal water. Under high pressure, some of these materials precipitate, they fall out, and accumulate on the floor of our little caverns and in the chambers and those cells in the structures of the rock. So it gets heavily loaded with these minerals. When pressure is released, the salt precipitates even more, explaining the high concentration of salt in the seas and on land and in domes on the ocean floor. High temperature water released as droplets with high surface area quickly loses its energy, heat, and in expansion. Now, all I got to say about this, if you got an air conditioner, every time you turn it on and the cooling thing works, that's what's happening inside that little box. Hot, compressed, freon used to be, I don't know what they use now, gets released, and when it gets released, it gets cold, it takes up the heat. So that's just the principle. When this is going to get released, it's going to release, it's going to be very, very cold because it expands immediately. That, you know, we think about this, you know, from last week, thought it's going to spray out this hot water. Well, it's going to scorch everybody and every animal in sight, and including the ark. Well, it won't be hot, it will be cold, very cold. All right, so that's kind of an important point. So with a summary of this little part, this earth was created with most of the water in the underground seas as trapped water under extreme pressure in the order of 4,100 atmospheres. That's 4,100 times 15. After the fall, and here we do not know what happened after the fall, but there have to be some changes in the physics of the earth, because it says the earth was subject to the fall, became subject to the curse of the fall. In time, due to friction, the water temperature rose to a high temperature well over the 800 degrees under high pressure. The water is contained in these connecting water vaults. These are all connected. They're not pockets by themselves. The water contained the connecting water vaults that have pillars that connect the upper ceiling with the lower floor. This connection is from creation and keeps the crust from spinning away from the inner earth mantle. Can you imagine outside would spin, inside to stop? You know, they're connected. Now, we have a couple of verses that point in that direction. Again, maybe we need some help here, but it seems like maybe these aren't so metaphorical. Maybe they are really true in terms of literal. Psalm 24:2 says, "And he's founded it upon the seas, the earth, and established it on the rivers." These are all rivers underneath here. These are the seas that are underneath here. Establishes it on it. Psalm 104:3 says, "And he lays the beams of his upper chambers in the water." These can be the beams of the upper chambers that hold up the crust. "And he makes the clouds of his chariots, he walks upon the wings of the wind." So that's outside this venue. He goes on to say in Psalm 104:5, he says, "He establishes the earth upon his foundations so that it will not totter forever and ever." Now, we've got to explain that forever and ever, but these foundations are perhaps what's meant here. Psalm 33:7 says, "He gathers the heavens to the sea, of the sea together in a heap, and he lays up the deeps in storehouses. Psalm 135:6 says, whatever the Lord pleases, he does in heaven and in earth, in the seas and in all deeps. So we have some reference here that maybe we just might not quite think so poetically and think maybe it's really referring to something that the psalmist maybe understood or didn't understand, but under inspiration recorded for us. So we're going to take our little study through four phases. We have the rupture phase, which is tonight. The next phase is the flood phase. And then the third phase is the continental drift phase. And then we have phase four, the recovery phase. Now, in the rupture phase, we have obviously fountains of the deep being broken up. And then we have the comets and asteroids and the material launched. You can't probably read those, so that's why I'm reading them to you. And we have the mammoth frozen. So that's kind of what we're going to do tonight. And then we have, just for your information, we have the continental slopes, shelves formed. That's next week or the next event here. Most fossils and limestone form, sediments and fossil sorted and layered by liquefaction. We have the coal, oil, and salt domes form in this continental phase, which is only a day long. Then we have the Kirby theory as the ocean trenches form, the submarine canyons form, the methane hydrates form, the plateaus form, magnetic variations on the ocean floor, Grand Canyon forms in weeks, sediment from table mounds form. We have the Ice Age, earthquakes, volcanic activity, Earth's axis processes, changes, and fossil ballasts, basalts slip up into Earth's surface. It's interesting with the earthquake. Somebody told me, so I didn't read it, but two people told me, so it must be true, that the Earth shifted 4 inches. The Earth's axis shifted 4 inches with that earthquake. Now, 4 inches isn't all that much, but you get the Earth to move at all, it's something. So we're going to find that is part of the scenario here. So we have, I read those for you already, we have the great fountains of the deep, we have the comets and asteroids and frozen mammoth tonight. By the way, you can get on the website, creationscience.com, and look these up if you want to look them up. You aren't taking copious notes tonight. A couple more verses that are interesting. In Psalm 18:15, it says that then the channels of water appeared, and the foundations of the world were laid bare. I think this has to do with the flood here. At your rebuke, O Lord, the blast of your breath of your nostrils. So God does this act, and these things happen. So we'll go back to one. We did 104:5, I think. It talks about the foundations that establish the earth upon the foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever. I don't think you need to read this. Did that kind of already. Whoops, too fast. So the cataclysmic flood is what Peter talks about in his letter about the flood. And it's the only place in the Bible where that word is used, cataclysma. It's the word that actually, just like our cataclysmic, it's in just Greek. And such a flood may be spoken of as a flood that destroys, or much water which destroys. Since it's only used of the flood, it must be the worst thing that happened to Earth, we can argue. And we know that story, how Peter develops it. He says at that time, the world was destroyed, being flooded with water. It probably just kind of goes by us, kind of like our fourth grade or four-year-old Sunday school classes. The Lord has flooded the water and people died. That was it, you know. But we don't really able to communicate to our little kids or how we need to have in our mind how big an event this really was. So we come to this catastrophe part. It says in Genesis 7:11, it says, and the fountains of the deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were open, which probably is pretty much the same event. And then later on, said the fountains of the deep were closed. So at this point, we have a little diagram that shows the moment of the fracture of the earth, the crack that started and spread around the world in 2 hours, with intersecting cracks like an egg would break. Now we have Isaiah 24:16. Just for time, I'm sure I'm going to be long or short today. I really don't, I can't tell. But I'm going to go to the next panel because this is what explains this passage. This is a passage that usually is understood as tribulation passage, and it is that. But it sources, I think, the flood event to warn about future more sure judgment, or just a sure judgment. Isaiah 24:18 says, "And it will be that he who flees the report of disaster will fall into a pit." You know, somebody's trying to run from God's hand, runs away. Well, first thing that'll happen to him, he'll fall into a pit. And then when he climbs out of the pit, he'll be caught in a snare, which is to say he's not going to get away. So now we have an image out of the Old Testament flood period, I think, that shows how no one got away in those days. Why do you think that you're going to get away in the tribulation? You know, for the Jews, it would be future time. So listen how this is described, this event. And I think some of the writers understand this is the flood because it says, "For the windows above are opened." That's just got to be the flood. That's just such that kind of language. But look what else it says. "And the foundations of the earth shake. The earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack. For its transgression is heavy upon it, and it will fall, never to rise again." Is that not what happened in the flood? Now, this rise, fall, never to rise again doesn't necessarily have to mean that it ceases to exist. But the world as it was known at that point is destroyed. It will never come back. So we have the foundation of the earth shaken. The earth is broken. Talk about the cracked egg. It is split through, talking about this split. It shakes violently. We've not talked about the axis change. And it reels to and fro like a drunkard. Again, the axis things, and it totters like a shack. So, I mean, I don't know how much more clear it can be unless this is just figurative talk, which a lot of people resort to. So, well, this is just figurative talk. That the earth really has never gone through that. If it do, it would fall apart. Well, maybe that's what the Lord is telling us here in a form of warning to the Jews for the tribulation. Well, the commentaries talk, won't give you much of this, but I just thought the middle part, he says, broken, cracked, and shaken, says, literally said, there is broken down the earth. There is cracked through earth. There is shaken earth. You know, in these Hebrew expressions, you know, wouldn't they translate them into English are kind of awkward. But even in the repetition, a certain variety is achieved by employing the definite article only once. In other words, this is an event that's significant. Now, I think this is expositors. No, this is Kyle and Dalich. Interesting what they said. That was a little surprising to me. They say about this passage, Isaiah 24:18 says, "For as a repetition of the flood for the opened windows or trapdoors of the firmament, which let the great bodies of water above then come down from on high upon the earth," points back to Genesis 7:11. We just read that in Genesis 8:2, where it closes it up. And implies, and it indirectly implies its universality, the flood, universal flood. It also describes it as an earthquake. The foundations of the earth are the internal supports upon which the visible crust of the earth rests. This is a different guy. This is not Mr. Brown writing this. The way in which the earth in its quaking first breaks, then bursts, then falls, is painted for the ear by the three reflective forms, which will keep each stage in the process of the catastrophe vividly before the mind. Hello? Okay. So here we go. Of course, it has to start with a microscopic hairline crack. It grew instantly to miles wide, taking all the displacement, debris, water mixed with minerals, elements into the high and a little even to the upper atmosphere into orbit. All released at 64,000 pounds PSI, and there may be other factors that are involved in here. Somewhere I might say it or I might forget where there's even the possibility of nuclear explosions occurring here as this is being released. Atoms get, if they get split, they release energy. So it may be more than just the pressure. There may be also other supporting factors that are not known. He, in the back of his book, he's got a scenario about this. He says, I don't want to publish this yet because I wouldn't have somebody check it for me. So he makes the point that in the future editions, probably more of this will come forth. I tell you, the more in detail you get sometimes, the more sophisticated you got to be what you're reading and the less understandable it is. So maybe you just well leave it out. Except you've got to put these out as possibilities because our mind sort of starts boggling. How can all this happen? So we start with this 10-mile-deep trench. You know, it's almost like instantly it's there. And it's, you know, 10 miles wide, 10 miles, you know, just pick a, I don't know why you pick those numbers. I think you pick wide, 10 miles wide because it's 10 miles deep. So you'd sort of figure that's how much would blow out right away. So this becomes a 10-mile-wide gash in the earth. In time, it grew to 800 miles, which is the average distance now between the continental, not shelves, but the continental slopes. I'll talk about that in a minute. Average. So there are places that are long, wider than that, which is the average in the Atlantic Pacific. So this is how it would look in the process. We still have South America and North America connected. Okay? So as this erosion goes, this gets pushed apart till the point you almost get to the shape of our continental continents. Now, we've got to take off the continental shelf and come up to the continental slope. I'll tell you the difference of those two words. But what happens to this, all this material that's blowing up? Well, let's see, this word, it's going and landing on land. And some of it, of course, falls back on the earth into the water. But then later, the water, the basement of the ocean will drop too. So that's not a problem. So we saw this last week. Basically, the picture, graphically, very simply shown that these become the fountains and the rain falls on the earth. And this is not just plain ordinary little rainwater. This is water that's laced with silicon and quartz and all the elements that will later on be used in these slurries that will actually become sandstone or rock, we call sedimentary rock, in which there will be all kinds of fossils, bearing things and so forth. Yeah. That's where we're going. Yep, that's where we're going. And what would be frozen? The mammoths.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay,
because
that's good.
That kind of a release of that much pressure all at once would have been, like you said, a horrific cooling effect.
Yeah, and it's cold to begin with, and then it goes high, and then it comes back down, like not cold rain, but ice and snow and mud and dirt and, yeah, okay. So here we have another factor that happens when this erosion occurs. This is my wonderful drawing here. I can't even show it to you. There it goes. All right. So this is our crust. And as the crust, Will this work? This is going to be the pressure point when the water rushes out, right? So here's what's going to erode. Well, if this gets eroded, which I show it did, then this is going to fall down eventually. So this water on the way up will pick up all the erosion and throw in air. Now, we talk about one more thing later on. It's called cavitation, that when this water hits these surfaces, it, in a sense, it explodes the rock. We don't have to think about hunks like this coming out, although that did, but we can also think of just pure mud. Because when this gets hit, it just destroys these pieces. You know, and anyway, the cavitation I'll explain in a minute. So what we have going up here is not necessarily big rocks, 100 pounds or 200 pounds, although some of them are probably that big, but most of it is just very, very small, finite stuff that ends up later on being sediment. And it goes up, and who knows how high. We know that some of it went even into the polar, into the orbital distance. So that means that it had to have some exit velocity. I'll talk about that in a minute, too. Real strong push to get it up there, you know. If you shoot your gun in the air, you're not going to get it in orbit pattern. It's not going to have that kind of velocity to get there. Okay, so eroding the Earth's upper crust, peeling back rock, polarizing it, and throwing the water, mineral, mud mixed into the atmosphere to fall as rain in the colder regions as snow and hail. And maybe in all regions it comes down that way and then melts. I don't know. We're in the eruption phase. This talks a little bit about the cavitation. This is the same idea here. Water's coming out here, and it goes up into supersonic flow. I say that the evolving, exploding water polarized surface of the metal or rock, making it a dust or powder carried aloft later sedimentary rock. Now, here is a piece of machinery. It's all of a hydraulic pump. And the first I saw this was on the History Channel, one of those channels that do these reporting things, and they showed propellers on boats. And they get all these little pits in these brass impellers. I said, where do those pits come from? They explained, well, that's cavitation. Because when those propellers turn, they put extreme amount of pressure in the water. When that water hits it, it explodes because of the, you know, like it would when it would boil. It hit the bubble, it would just explode. Well, that's actually not quite how it is, but that's the idea of it. And it's such force, it digs holes into this copper plate or the brass plate. So that's the same thing we're going to talk about later on when we get to the Grand Canyon. When that water came down that canyon, you don't have to look for big boulders downstream where they all landed, because it was all ground into these little fine pieces of grains of sand and smaller that got washed out into the Baja Peninsula, which you look under deep in the water, you'll find that's where the delta is. So the same kind of process would easily work here. So I'm going to read through the cavitation. I think I explained that enough for you. Okay. So I want you to think of big rocks flying in the air, although that could have happened. Most of it was finer stuff. Now, on these regions that have the greatest force, greatest erosion, see this, let me read this. The water's horizontal velocity, that's this water coming out this way, going up like my yellow line. The water's horizontal velocity and erosion power increase to the right, going this way, because the water pressure decreases as it approaches the right edge. The water pressure decreases as it approaches the right edge because it's getting freedom here. The hydroplate will sag downward, forcing the flow to an increasing erosion even more, digging the bottom of this out. The bottom right of the hydroplate will, in effect, be beveled by the erosion, causing the top incline downward. The process formed continental shelves, which is this part. This is the shelf, this is the slope. So it made the shelves and the slopes, particularly the slopes around the world. Now those shelves are off the continents. So you think from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, let's just pick from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and we're talking of, well, as it ends up, the Atlantic Ocean is quite deep. Pacific is even deeper. I think that's right, the other way around. Whatever's taken out of the ocean, to a large extent, that amount of water, that amount of material has been blown out of the ocean and now is laid on the land. Probably not exactly the way to say it, but where did that sediment come from that's on our land? Well, it had come from the part that's now in the ocean. All right. So we have Europe, Asia, and Africa, and Americas were generally in the position shown, but were joined across what is now the ocean. So in other words, this used to be connected. When this blowout occurred, this is what was blown out. And then we have the little issue of the ice age, which got melted, then put more water back in the ocean, raised the ocean again another 300 feet. So we got to be careful what we're thinking here. So the pre-flood crust were deep and shallow seas and mountains, generally smaller than those of today, but some as perhaps high as 5,000 feet, perhaps as high as 5,000 feet. Remember, if you take all the water in the world today and put it on a smooth ball, you have 8,000 feet of water. And he started out by saying half of it came out of the underground fountains, half of it, so it's 4,000 feet of it. So that's probably why he's guessing that the mountains were not over 5,000 feet. Probably that's pushing a little bit, although the 5,000 feet, no one knows how high they were. We know that the boat, the ark could float over it, but we don't know how high that really was. Okay, now this blowout channel we have darkened in here. I wish I could sit here and talk to him a little more, because it seemed like if it's going to be like an egg, there's going to be some crossover cracks, you know? And maybe that's what some of these are. We have one that goes this way, one that goes this way. But the way he talks in the book, he talks like there's one crack that basically goes around the world like this. And I don't, he says it goes up through the Bering Strait, and I don't see it here, but then this is a mapping of today's ocean floors from satellite. So it maybe doesn't show everything you might want to see, but he says that this crack went around the world and came down on the Pacific side, this is the Atlantic side. Of course, when you see a map like this, this at the bottom is way pushed out. You got to pull it all back together to one point here in the bottom. So you see these things are not nearly as far apart as they look. All right, so we have this is that slot, and then it blew it wide open to the continental shelf, and here's your continental shelf. These are the continental shelves. You see the dark blue and light blue? That's the shelf. So this was all blown out in time over 40 days while all that water is coming out from underneath the plate, the upper plate, which was floating on the water. So after we have the flood, if it got going, we have, in a sense, the waters now over the continents covering them. And as time went on, this water disappeared to a small amount, and it's all settled down some kind of equilibrium. And part of what he's going to do in this hydroplate theory is that these continents are going to start sliding. And when they start sliding, they will go fine until they hit something that's sliding the other way, and then they crumple up. And that's what you have, like on the Rocky Mountains, and you have other places in South America, and the western coast of Chile, all those mountains are pushed up. And so that's because these have slid together on a hydroplane, on water, slid together after the flood action had occurred, and the mountains were formed then. You see that? Hey, I think in the list I had that when the mountains were formed, it happened one day, which is hard to believe. I mean, I can't imagine moving that much in one day. The force would be absolutely incredible. Just a little peek into the present. We have these flumes. They kind of look like flumes to me. Supercritical water, man, that's high pressure, high temperature water, still is underneath the Earth's crust. We call this the crust. And it's still leaking out. So all of it didn't get dispensed, which would make sense. And all of it doesn't get escaped. So these little geysers continue to blow in the ocean floor. And they're just left over from the same event, except it's a whole lot smaller. I called the exponentially smaller magnitude, and they're called black smokers. And they just sit there and just pump out. So where did all this come from? Now, you know, people that don't believe in creation science, they've got to come up with something. But Mr. Brown's come up with a plausible reason. Now we come to the mammoths. Should I try my mouse again? Come on. Didn't help a bit, did it? Well, I've got to do it the other way then. All right. So we have the axis shift will be a later lesson. Months later, after mountains were suddenly pushed up, and this would be now, I shouldn't give you the timeline here because I think this is supposed to be later. But he talks about the woolly mammoth, so he's got to look ahead and kind of deal with them. Months later, after mountains were suddenly pushed up the Earth's surface shifted, the axis of the Earth rolled 35 to 45 degrees. Now, that is a lot. Remember, you go from 90 degrees to 0 degrees, that's the equator. So half of that, up to half that roll. So Siberia and Alaska moved from temperate latitudes similar to South Central Canada and Central United States today to the present position as the floodwaters drained off the continents, the icy graves in warmer climate and buried animals decayed. However, many animals buried in what are now permafrost regions were preserved. And then that thing rolled back. I shouldn't try to do that for you. Probably wrong. Did I go too far? I think that wasn't in there yet. Months later, we did that. I thought I had two panels there. Yeah, I missed one before. Yeah, that's the one I missed. Okay, sorry. It does two things too quickly. Hydroplate theory. On that terrible day, the rupture of the Earth's crust passed between what is now Siberia and Alaska. Where that? I'll read it again. Jetting water from the fountains of the great deep first fell as rain. I did not read this. During the first next few hours, some of the accelerating, expanding subterranean water that went above the atmosphere, where the effective temperature is several hundred degrees below zero, Fahrenheit frozen, fell as hail. Some animals were suddenly buried, suffocated, frozen, compressed by tons of cold, muddy ice crystals from gigantic hailstorm. And that's what these animals have found. Some are even standing up. They just got dumped on. Dirt in this ice prevented it from floating as the floodwaters submerged these regions after days or weeks. Blankets of this muddy ice, hundreds of feet thick, insulated and preserved, many animals are in the flood phase. At the topmost layers of ice, as the topmost layer of the ice melted, dirt in that ice remained and settled, blanketing further, insulating the deeper ice buried the animals, and of course then later to be discovered as the ice continued to melt over the years. Now we have this other one which already did that, actually shifted. But what triggered the flood? Well, the earth was created all good. So we'd have to say that the earth could have continued into eternity without any adjustments or physical structures. Earth was a safe place, no threat of weather, earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamies, or even falling meteorites. In fact, I think about that. Would God told Adonai, be careful when you walk outside, there might be a meteor or two fall on you? No, that was not a possibility. So if meteors are going to fall, then something has triggered that event, which would be the sin issue. Well, how do those meteors get out there if God didn't create them? God didn't create them, apparently. I didn't create them in the condition they were. So we have an answer for them. They were thrown into space. And now they're up there. What goes up comes down, or at least a lot of them do. However, the fall not only affected man, it affected the universe and most closely planet Earth. While the morning of the next day seemed normal, the time bomb began its ticking countdown, or it began, maybe, as God said, 120 days before the flood. You know, it says 120 days left, you know, when a spirit will not strive with man, there's 120 days left, years left. So it's possible that, you know, everything stayed in equilibrium until then. But I have my thinking that probably it started right away. So, after the ark was closed a few days, the explosion discharging engine was triggered. I call this whole thing more of an engine than just one explosion, because it continued for 40 days and 40 nights. And it was peeling off these rocks and cavitizing the edges and throwing them into space. It went on and on, almost like an engine. It just not one event. Now, the rupture mechanism, tidal pumping. Each tidal cycle, twice a day, we know about the tides in our oceans, due to the sun and moon's gravity, stretched and compressed these pillars. The cycle of compression, extension, tidal pumping went on for 2,000 years, actually 2,548 years. 2,438 years. That's BC. No, it's 1,600. I was right. It's over 2,000 years. From 4,000 BC. From 4,000 BC to be about 1,600 years. He says 2,000 years. I got to change it. Okay, this action heated and expanded the pillars and subterranean water, steadily increasing the pressure in the chamber. So this, that's energy. Where's it going to go? Just gets hotter and hotter and more pressure. Every time the earth goes around once, more pressure. Now, some of it dissipates. Other things happen to it. But in the long run, it doesn't all get lost. It stays put. So we have all this energy in a closed compartment. As the temperature rose, the water became supercritical. And we have here's the issue about the nuclear reaction. Oxygen would support combustion if there was suitable fuel. And here it suggests nuclear reaction here is if it was present. The pillars in the crust are weakened and cracking. The pillars began to collapse, and then the domino effect caused the increased pressure in the supercritical water chambers. The increased temperature of these columns get real hot, and the expelled rock and debris as meteorites were at some point in excess of 1,300 degrees. So, you know, did you know that the early people got their iron from meteors? They didn't dig for it. In fact, you go to Arizona, ever been to the crater of Arizona? Have you seen the big piece of iron that lays there they have on display? It's about this big long, with this about this high. And for a long time, they said that before they wanted to not believe in catastrophism, they didn't want to believe that a meteor hit that. But when they start finding these iron fragments, and this is a pretty big size fragment, laying around, not only in, they never found anything in it, but they found laying around it, they decided that it really was a meteor that hit this. So the early people got their iron from meteors before they could mine it. Well, they think of these irons comes out of these, I don't know why he says that. Whether these are because that is iron that they were used there, or they were kept there, and these otherwise they got eroded. I don't know, but he says that that's where the iron came from these places. And so we know that the meteors do shower out iron, so that would make sense. At least it came from the subterranean cavities. So we have this pumping action here. We show it here exaggerated graphically. These are the columns. And we have this elongating pumping going back and forth. I think you get the point of that. The water layer under the Earth's pre-flood crust largely decoupled from the mantle that gave the crust a spherical shell, much greater flexibility than if it would have been anchored and bonded over the entire mantle surface, as it is today. In other words, today it's more or less touching it. In other words, the few shearing stresses acted on the base of the crust, allowing it to flex more freely from the sphere to prolate ellipsoid during each tidal wave. So it changes shape all the time. Also, the moon's gravity lifted the crust at 12 o'clock, not noon, but, you know, on the clock here. The crust was depressed at 9 o'clock, 3 o'clock. Consequently, confirmed subterranean waters was always pumped by increasing pressure from low to high. So that process goes on for 1,600 years, and something finally had to give. Now, again, something had to happen after the creation, because if the fall wouldn't have happened, the world wouldn't have exploded. Don't know what that is. So the critical point, we have this rupture. Cracked open, decreased the pressure, mineral saturated water, pulverized rock is ejected from the slot at high rates of speed. Now here we said the launch velocity to escape Earth's gravity is 33 kilometers a second, or 20 miles per second. And I looked up a high speed velocity rifle muzzle discharges at 1 mile a second, so it'll be 20 times faster than a high-powered rifle to get that into upper space. So these guys that are in the Middle East that are shooting the bullets in the air, they're not going to go anywhere. They're going to come right back down. So now we have the comet. 5 minutes. Got to do it. Comet, asteroid, and meteorite material launched. That's our next section here. We did the mammoth already, didn't we? We're getting along. Right, all right. The foundations of the Great Deep launch rockets as well as muddy water. As rocks move further away from the Earth's gravity became less significant to them, and the gravity of nearby rocks became increasingly significant. So rocks start stick to each other because of the gravity. We don't understand this on Earth because we only have one gravity that really affects us, and that's what's down there. But you throw these rocks in the air and they don't have any other gravity affected them, they will glue together. They will move together. And so when they're outer space being thrown out there, they start finding themselves, they find themselves together. The bigger one will attract little guys, and pretty soon you got an asteroid. So we have, consequently, many rocks, assisted by their mutual gravity and surrounding clouds of water vapor included, merge to become asteroids. Drag forces caused by water vapor and thrust forces produce the radiometric, this is like the sun shines on something, and actually you've seen the little wheels that turn in a glass. Well, that's what we're talking about here. This radiometer effect actually kind of blows these particles. The effect of these asteroids in what is now the asteroid belt. The so-called mavericks of the solar system, asteroids, meteoroids, and comets, resulted from the explosive events at the beginning of the flood. Now, here is an asteroid. This is called asteroid Ida, and the moon Dactyl, I don't know how you say that. So here's the asteroid, and here's his moon. It's 1 mile in diameter, 60 miles away. So this guy goes around this guy. Okay, so from a distance, large asteroids look like big rocks. However, many show by their low density that they contain either much empty space or something light, such as water or ice. Also, the best close-up pictures of an asteroid shows millions of smaller rocks on its surface. Therefore, asteroids are flying rock piles held together by gravity. Ida, about 35 miles long, does not have enough gravity to squeeze itself into a spherical shape. So that's why they look kind of funny like that. But this is basically a bunch of rocks that are just held together by their gravity. And they didn't all come out off the earth as one hunk like that. They found each other by gravity. So the largest Ceres, I don't know how you'd say that, nearly 600 miles in diameter, has about one-third of all the volume of the asteroids combined. 30,000 other asteroids have been encountered and tracked. Many are less than 20 feet in diameter. Some have fallen to Earth, would do great damage. We saw one in Arizona. Now look at these patterns of these asteroids, how they're distributed around the sun. So if they came from the Earth, and Earth goes around the sun, what would you think might happen to the asteroid particles? Do the same thing. They follow along. Duh, that's what you got. I don't know why I put that in there, but I was going to take it out, but I forgot. So isn't that a good picture of Mother Earth here? The size of the sun planets, especially asteroids, are magnified, but the relative positions are accurate. About 90% of the 30,000 precisely known asteroids lie between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. A donut-shaped region called this asteroid belt. A few asteroids cross the Earth's orbit and fall to Earth. Look at the pattern around the sun, not around the Earth, because Earth is going around the sun, so that which it shoots off is going to go around the sun too. And it took a while for it to happen, so I don't know if that's why the scattering occurs, because you take a year to go around the sun. But, you know, these things have a tendency to drift, they pull each other, and there's a deal, which I didn't look into, the deal about why these asteroids are clustered around these planets. And I think it's probably because the gravitational force of those two planets are big enough to attract these asteroids, but they actually came from Earth. So one assumption is that one assumption is that there was high pressure water in the lowest chambers of the Earth since creation. Stable, but sin changed that condition. That moon gravity caused tidal pumping in the water caverns, lifting and lowering the ceilings, columns, and in time caused stress fracture across the Earth. The fracture started in one place, marched as a zipper around the Earth in 2 hours and for 40 days and nights, releasing the pressure by expelling the water, cavitating rock, minerals as large and small particles into the lower atmosphere as some into orbital attitudes. And by the way, 0.5% of the material of the Earth was blown out at that time. In a way, a lot, but not a lot. You know, you think about 0.5% of the material of the Earth is gone. It seems like it has some effect on the Earth, and it probably does, but it isn't all that much. Remember, the Earth is big. So the fissure began perhaps 10 miles wide, recapping here, grew to an average 800 miles in 40 days. This constant high pressure erosion from the water vaults formed the continental shelf, slope, not the shelf. The displaced material shooting up and raining on the landmass raised the continents and the sedimentary rock and soils. The meteorites, asteroids, comets, and so forth are Earth materials. Some have bacteria, living bacteria, and water. Remember, Earth is the water planet. You don't find water elsewhere. So if water in it, it probably came from the Earth. Life did not come from outer space, but Earth sent life into outer space. They get it mixed up, don't they? And there we are, folks, right on time. Now, if you ask a question that I can't answer, I'm just going to tell you, I don't know. So, but if you have one or a comment, yeah, Larry.
Wouldn't Yellowstone be kind of a look at a rupture?
Well, it's a volcano.
But with all of the water geysers that are hot?
I'm going to deal with that. Because somehow he says, and I've read this much of it, he says, they talk about the core of the Earth is different than what we've thought. What I've seen him say, the core is hard. And then there's a layer around that's molten. And he doesn't attribute these volcanoes to that molten. There's some other else here, and I can't answer that, where he gets this from. But so he does the volcanoes on the last phase, on the recovery phase. That's when they show up. They don't show up here in these first days. First 40 days, show up in the end. This is after the continental slide has occurred, and this probably disrupted the surface of the Earth that, you know, causes these eruptions that would not have had otherwise.
Don, explain the gravity that caused these rocks to stick together.
That's something no one can do. But mass attracts mass. The more mass you have, the more it's going to attract. The little guy's got to go to the big guy. So that's, I don't think they know. Maybe that's what it says in the Bible, that God, the Lord, holds it together with the word of his mouth. You know, and now we can quickly do a miracle thing here if we want to, but there could also be a very scientific explanation for it too. Yeah.
Well, there's been little meteorites that have dropped to the Earth. How do they get out of that cycle?
Well, then they slow down. Whatever goes up comes down. You know, if they didn't quite achieve the height or the speed that they should or could stay forever, they eventually will come down. True. And maybe we sit here for 10 more million years, they will all come down. Or go off into space. You know, they can't stay in equilibrium forever. Yeah.
You suppose they had a climate change attitude back in the time before the flood?
Well, I still have that in reserve. You know, Whitcomb, those guys talked about the Earth was a greenhouse. I think they're coming to that conclusion because of the mammoths that were found in the northern. These guys take care of that by the tilting of the earth. So maybe he would say there would have been seasons in the original earth.
I'm thinking of what they're talking about, the earth warming attitude that Mr. Gore has.
Well, that stuff's off the chart. So
I mean, you wonder if man had that kind of an attitude back then.
Oh, probably worse. It must have been worse because God destroyed the world, and Al Gore is still walking around, so we know it must have been worse.
What about the, Ogallala water?
Yes, these other aquifers are going to be higher, we call them perched water. They're up higher, they're not in this lower.
Is that right?
Yeah. And he would say that these lower caverns can never be refilled. Because the pressure wouldn't let it. If you had a hole down there, if it would stay open at all, it wouldn't be able to lift all this rock for the water. So he's got to exclude these surface, what we call maybe within 100 feet or 200 feet, like we call the Ogallala aquifer. They get replenished.
Don, was he able to offer any estimate as to how much greater the diameter of the earth would have been prior to this?
I don't know that that's going to change much, except he does say that the Earth would rotate it at 360 cycles a year rather than 365. So it has sped up a little bit, which would mean that it is a little smaller.
Slimmer.
Huh? Bummer?
It's slimmer.
Slimmer, yeah. Well, just like a skater, the smaller it gets, the faster her hit, whatever. They're pulling the arms to go faster. So if the world got smaller, it would tend to speed up. So maybe he'll explain that. I've got through just a little bit of this book. It's fascinating. You have interest in this. And the book is only $30. I thought it might be more than that, only $30 compared to what you get in it. Now, the danger of this is, it says, this is one man's writing. It's overwhelming what he's done. I mean, it's his life. So... But I like his humble attitude in the sense that I'm wrong, show me, and we'll fix it. Rather than say, well, I'm sure this is it, there's no one going to improve on this. So, but the breadth of the subjects that he deals with in here is incredible. So it has to be a lifetime work. Yeah, Mike?
Have you done any more reading about these mammoths that have been found that are frozen? I mean, other than what you've mentioned, it would seem like there'd be lots of things besides just
Well, yes, there are. Well, I was trying to think in that book I call The Fingerprints of God. I think they found even humans' remains in those places. It's rhinos and mammoths. I guess the mammoths become the newsmaker, where the smaller animals probably wouldn't. But you would think, you're right, there would be other animals too that would seem to be, would have been caught in that downpour of hail and frozen material.
I thought that was our oil today.
Our oil is going to come from fossils. That's true. And I haven't read that part yet either. See, I just figured I'd do the rupture today and we do these others later.
Does he give a time on that, the continental splits or dividing?
Yes, one day.
So he's actually taking continental drift and speeding it up to one thing.
Yeah, he doesn't believe in the continental drift
right.
because they don't.
Over,
right.
That's over.
But we're, yeah, it's a continental slip. Yeah, as this, what happens when this, I think this how this goes, when this load of this upper crust gets removed, this starts raising up. I mean, it's just like anything soft. You take away the pressure here, and so you get this lift here, and we have it probably can't say one thing after the other completely separate from each other, but as it lifts, it's on a hydroplane, and then these continents start to slide. And they get a certain point, they call it angle of repose, when it starts to slide off. So when it gets to a certain angle, and it just whoosh, slides off, that's where he's going to go with this.
Can we assume that in the beginning there was no, the heat was strictly because of the tidal pumping, the change in pressure created the heat, T1B1, T1E1, T2B2, and then, but the very center of the earth, we don't know, is that what?
Well, most scientists say it's molten.
Yeah,
he says it's not.
Okay. And so if it is molten, it had to have gotten molten at creation.
And he doesn't think it was.
Okay.
Now, if it's molten, if there's something molten down there, what do you suppose that might be called? Four-letter word. Don't think too hard. It says hell was created. And if the world's going to last forever, where else but the bowels of the earth would you expect hell to be? He's not said that yet, but my mind's going there thinking, we come on a world. Hell is not some, maybe it's a real place, like real place, like we think of it, a literal place.
So when it says that the earth was formless and void, it probably was just a smooth...
Big ball of water. And it was the wall of water, according to this theory, is that it's so big, 2 light years across the diameter. And then it starts separating the water from the water, and that's the next day.
It was all covered with water.
It was water. It was the deep.